Coming up, have you ever given a personal guarantee as a founder? Well, hear the painful thing that happened to today's guest when she did it and get some advice on how you should handle it yourself. Also, do you want to see how to find a hit business? I'm going to ask today's guest about the process that she and her co-founder took when they found that the first version of their company didn't exactly rock and how they turned it around and made it into a business that people are eager to be a part of and eager to be customers of. All that and so much more. You're going to want to stay tuned coming up. First, three messages. Who's the lawyer that founders in the Mixergy audience trust? Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Have you seen what Chris Pritchard posted on my Facebook page? His new companies and corporation pages that Scott Edward Walker helped him get. Scott Edward Walker is the lawyer that publications like Forbes trust. Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, when my friend had to close her company's office but still wanted to give callers the impression that all her employees work well under one roof together, what service did she use? Grasshopper. With Grasshopper, everyone who works for you could have an extension. They can pick up calls on their extensions no matter where they are or what phones they use, and they can transfer calls to each other back and forth with ease. Get those features and tons more at grasshopper.com. Finally, when Dave Jackson and Dave Petrillo invented a product that keeps coffee at the perfect temperature, what platform did they use to create their online store? Shopify.com. Look at how beautiful their store looks. It's because it's built on Shopify. They did hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales. Shopify stores are designed to help you sell. Patrick Buckley invented an iPad case and used Shopify as his online store. Within months, he sold over $1 million in cases. Get your beautiful online store at Shopify.com. Here's a program. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and home of over 700 entrepreneurs who have come here to tell you their stories of how they built their businesses. How does a founder have multiple setbacks and still go on to build a hit business? Kelly Fitzsimmons once found herself on the hook for millions of dollars in debt. She did something painful to get out from under it, and I want to learn from it, and I'll ask her about it in this interview. Today, she is the co-founder of Harkin, whose software makes voice much more useful. Among its applications, Harkin's technology allows employers to automate phone interviews with prospective employees, and their latest product, Symposia, makes the conference calls and the webinars that you do right now totally searchable by voice. So you don't just search for the PowerPoint slides, you can search for voice. I don't know how that's possible. We're going to find out about that, and more importantly, how she built the business around it here in this interview. Kelly, thank you for doing this interview.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let me start off with the painful part, and then I'll quickly ask about the positive part. The painful part, how deep in debt were you?
At the height of it, before we were able to restructure things, I was personally guaranteed for $5
million. $5 million, you personally on the hook, you can't escape from it by saying, hey, I'm walking away from the company.
No. The company at that point had already been folded. So this was bank debt. This was contracted debt that I had personally guaranteed.
All right. In the interview, we're going to talk about how you got into debt, why it made sense at the time, and how you got out of it. But let's skip quickly for a second to the happy ending. Sure. Harkin found its voice. It now basically makes voice searchable online. How do you know now that it's a hit, that the business is as well off as I'm telling my audience it is?
Yeah, customers ultimately tell you. I mean, the thing that's kind of nice about business is that at least the type of startup that I run is it's revenue. You can start to see whether or not people are buying your things. And is it accelerating? Are they buying more of it? Are you starting to get a nice growth curve? What's the month over month rate? And so we're getting some really nice traction. And also we've got world-class customers. So our customers,
name drop a little bit. Who are some of the customers?
Adecco, Manpower, Randstad, those three customers alone make up over 80% of all the revenue in staffing and recruiting.
What size revenue are you guys doing now?
So we're a privately held company. We don't disclose. But I can tell you that we've doubled our revenue over everything that we did last year in the first quarter.
Can I say this, that you're doing over a million in sales? I read an article where you said we're going to do a million in sales. Have you guys hit that in annual sales?
Well, I can't say. I can't say. It's actually from a privacy standpoint, we've got a lot of disclosure issues right now. So I can't. I apologize.
Okay.
There's actually our investors sign non-disclosures regarding our financials, which is a different story for maybe a different episode. But I'd be happy to
You mean why your investors signed non-disclosure is a
Yep,
diff why did
exactly.
they?
I'm sorry?
Why did they sign a non-disclosure? I thought investors.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's to be able to get the full financial information. We just had some issues with disclosure and people sharing information inappropriately. And because we have such a large investor base, it's easy to happen and it can hurt the company. So we have to be really careful.
You know what, Kelly? You're right. This is a whole interview on its own, but I've got to tell you that you bring up a point that we don't talk enough about in the startup world, which is I've heard other entrepreneurs say, hey, I sent out these weekly emails to my investors. They're all angel investors. I wanted to keep them in the loop because they're also going to advise me. And I told them about some of my setbacks. And bam, the setbacks that I was having that I was being open about, they were sharing it with their friends. They weren't holding. So this is something that we should just keep it as a whole other interview. Let's in this.
Absolutely.
But
I've got lots of ideas.
I'm glad that you brought it up. It's not a topic that I could ever get deep in depth on because we can never call anyone out on it. It's just not going to work properly in an interview, but I'm glad that we're starting to talk about it a little bit. All right, let's go back and focus here. Before you even built this, you were a student who was dyslexic, had severe ADHD. What is ADHD?
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Okay.
So there's a lot of folks who think it's some sort of just, trumped up diagnosis. But if you've ever had or seen a truly hyperactive child, that was me. And I basically ran in circles for the first 6 years of my life. I just could not settle
You
down.
mean literally you'd run in circles in the living room at home?
Oh yeah, and anywhere. And so for most of school up until high school, I was in the principal's office constantly. I just couldn't settle down. I could not sit still.
Were you also at all entrepreneurial? Did any of this, the person who you became, was that in there?
Oh yeah.
What did you do?
So I had a lot of businesses. I mean, before the age of 13, I can't even tell you how many businesses I started. Some of them were door to door. Some of them involved me setting up a shop at the end of the driveway. Let's see. One of them, this is when I was living in Florida, was selling coconut and driftwood to tourists. I was 7 years old, and everything was $20 because that sounded like a good number. And so when they asked me, how in the world I could justify selling a coconut in 1978 for $20, I pointed to the tree. I had to go obviously climb and get the coconut, and they, oh my gosh. Well, cool. Yeah, coconuts do fall. I don't know. Yeah, so they're heavy. But
You know what?
good question to me.
I remember the founder of StubHub telling me about how when he was a kid, he was selling, I think it was toys or candy in school, and he got shut down. Did that happen to you?
Oh, sure.
What were
My
you
mom did that.
selling?
One of my schemes. One of them was Kids Club International, where I went door to door. And it was $20 to join Kids Club, because that 20 was my magic number. To club join Kids Club International, and it was connecting children from around the world. Now, again, this is 1978. We didn't have the internet, at least we weren't aware of the internet back then. We certainly didn't have access to it in rural Florida. So, yeah, my mom caught on to that scheme, and I had to go back and return all the money.
How about school? Did they shut you down too?
That's interesting. I actually got away with it at school. By then, I had moved on to more socially responsible enterprises and ones that had genuine business models behind it and were not so seedy. In middle school, high school, I started starting clubs, and then of course, I wasn't going to have just one club. I had to start the club that ruled them all. So I started a club that essentially was in charge of all the clubs to ensure that we had a voice with the student council. So that they would have adequate time, and we lobbied to make sure that we had time alongside sports, and that it was you could do it either or, you didn't have to be a jock. So I was able to get the chess club off of the athletic requirement, because if they were doing chess after school, I mean that was a competitive sport in a sense.
By the way, what did you do to, you don't seem hyper. You're not obviously circling around. You're sitting down and doing this interview. What'd you do to eventually calm down?
You know, it's funny. I still have an incredible amount of energy, but it is called having two small children. So I have a child at the age of 6 and a child at the age of 4. And having two small children really does, you know, take a lot of energy out. But for me, what ends up happening is I look like a normal human and not somebody running in circles still. So it's age.
Okay. All right. Sun Tzu, that was the first big business that you were part of. Were you the founder of it or you founded it?
I started the company in 1996 at the tender age of 25.
At 25. And what was Sun Tzu? I mean, I see it here on my screen in my notes, but sure. For people who don't know what Sun Tzu's security was, what was it?
We were, as far as we can tell, we were the first pure play information security consultancy in the world, dedicated to helping businesses protect their mission critical information. So you have to remember, in 1996, I started this company before most people knew what email was or a web browser. And so what a firewall was, what intrusion detection was, being hacked, none of that was really part of the common vocabulary. So it was really ahead of its time. And in some ways, I really paid for that, which was 3 years of really trying to get some sort of market created around the concept that information was important and need to be secure, which was very hard to do because that was now the go-go 90s, right? So everything was about access and everything was about scalability. And I'm saying, shut it down. And you can imagine how well it was received. I was pretty much a Pollyanna. And which is kind of funny because here I am, you know, this very negative message and my personality is quite positive. So I can't imagine what I sounded like, particularly back then. And then when the dot-com bust happened, you know, you started to see a little bit uptick in interest in security, but it really didn't happen until 9/11, unfortunately. And post 9/11 was when information security really, in my opinion, became an industry. I mean, bigger than, you know, RACF or, you know, mainframe security and that kind of thing. I mean, at that point, client service security and internet security really came into vogue.
And you were still around then. You sold the business, I think it was January 2003?
Yep. I sold Sun Tzu in 2003 to Neo Hafsas. And prior to them, in the go-go 90s, I had started the business that would be my undoing.
But before we get into that, I want to just understand... You're telling me that you're selling security in a world where people just don't understand the value of it. But did you get any clients pre 9/11? I'll ask you about what you did after 9/11. But how'd you get clients before 9/11?
Oh, blood, sweat, and tears. I mean,
can you give me an example? I want to learn. I love these kinds of stories.
Yeah. So you know, at first, you know, I was going for small businesses because I figured small businesses needed my services because I assumed that enterprise Fortune 500 Global 2000 clients. Well, they had Deloitte, they had Accenture, they had, at the time, Arthur Anderson. So I figured they were covered. So my market niche was going to be small business. And they had absolutely no interest in security. I mean, that was not in the budget. It wasn't on the radar. They didn't get it. So in the beginning, interestingly enough, I started working with a series of nonprofits, particularly at technical museums, where they had the issue of the kids coming in and surfing porn on some of the core computers. So, I mean, but the good news was I got in front of the board of directors and they could say, wow, I'm so impressed. You can do this. I'm worried about people doing this at work. And that was how I got my early client list together, was actually working with nonprofits at very, very low rates that they could afford. But it was a marketing expense to really try and ensure that I got in front of their board of directors who ran large, you know, concerns. And it was from that I actually started a relationship with a gentleman who was on my board of directors for many years and was a great personal mentor to me. And unfortunately, he just died this year. He just passed away. So very sad. A gentleman by the name of George Dalton, who was the founder and CEO at the time of Fiserv. And Fiserv is still today one of the world's largest back-end transaction processors of financial data. And they have well over 10,000 banks that they run the back office systems for. So George was one of my first and earliest fans, but found my lack of revenue. And I mean, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was over $1 million, but it was, you know, it was, like I said, blood, sweat, and tears. you know, just befuddling, because he had started this company. It was worth billions. And, you know, he liked to say, you know, I don't mean to insult you, but your business is, you know, really small potatoes, Kelly. I know. I'm only doing this because, you know, you're a good person. I said, I realize I'm a charity case.
You're doing over $1 million in sales, and you must be proud of the fact that you hit a big milestone, and he's still making you feel like it's small potatoes, and you're going along with that.
Oh, well, I was, yeah. I mean, I actually, back then, there wasn't like it is today with all the data being so easily had, and I didn't know that $1 million was big shakes, really. I didn't know that, you know, the vast majority of businesses never get to that. I mean, and it was incredibly hard to get there. I mean, it was painful. So I'll tell you a quick George story, because this is really helpful just to get a sense of how bad the market was. Because people now today can't imagine a time where people didn't care about their information. It seems like, you know, it would just have always been. But in 1998 or 99, really in the height of the upturn, everybody's being so excited about this internet thing. And George takes me aside and he says, you know, Kelly, I just can't stand it. You're just beating your brains out. You know, you're so smart. You're so talented. You know, just stop. Nobody wants what you're selling. Just stop now. I can't stand it. I can't stand to watch this. And I didn't cry then, but I cried later. And I said, George, you're wrong. People care. Now remember, he's the CEO of the organization at the time that was doing the vast majority of the bank transaction back-end processing for financial institutions. I mean, you know, nobody cares about security, Kelly. Stop. Give it up. It's not a market. So,
And then the way that you got it at first was just by saying, I'm going to go in and give these clients what they think they want or what they want. And then I'll sell them what they want and give them what they need. They want anti-porn software. I'll go win the door and give them some of that, but then I'll introduce them to security, and that's how I'll get my security customers. And that works so for you. And then
yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I mean, it's like, you know, a lot of what we did was, what do you need? What problem are you trying to solve? And with professional services, you can do that. You can't do that particularly as well or easily with product, but, you know, it's solution-based selling. And, you know, what we ultimately did was make a lot of companies far more secure than they would have been otherwise. But, you know, one of the reasons I'm not in security today was that by the time everybody got excited about security and started seeing it, and there's chief security officers and chief information security officers and the chief privacy officers, by the time those positions were carved out by the Global 2000, it was too late. You know, the horse was out of the barn for like 3 years. And the systems, you know, to this date, I can't say that any system has not been penetrated. And it's not still probably vulnerable, if not open in some, you know, major way. It's almost impossible. So it became, you know, very sad. It was just, by the time I should have been celebrating my success and saying, yes, see, look, I was right. I was so sad because I didn't fix the problem. I didn't, you know, save the day. And
but did you get to capitalize on it afterwards?
Sure. I mean, but, you know, for me, you know, capitalization, I had a good return, but it was, as you know, I had some lingering debt. So.
Oh, I see. Okay. So business was starting to get better after 9/11.
Sun Tzu. Business was always steady and good for Sun Tzu. Where business was not good was on the startups I started on the side.
And this was, I'm sorry, one more thing actually on this. You told our producer, Jeremy Weiss, that said, I spent 8 years being CEO and doing it badly. So far, it seems like everything at Sun Tzu was, you know, life wasn't great because you couldn't persuade enough customers to change their worldview. But lots of people can't persuade strong-headed entrepreneurs and other business people to change their worldview. What do you mean by I was a bad CEO.
I was a terrible CEO.
What did you do?
So what did I do? I started two other businesses while I had Sun Tzu going.
Why is that a bad thing? I hear a few entrepreneurs do that.
Well, it was an ego thing, first off. I mean, it was the go-go 90s. I had not come out of an MBA program and became an entrepreneur. I had my master's in comparative religion. I mean, so I had studied something that was fairly esoteric and you know, had very limited business experience before I started my own company. So it was a lot of ego. I'm reading these articles about, you know, grow this and scale that, and, you know, why start one when you can start two or three? And there was a lot of very credible people at the time that were saying a lot of things that I believed to be true, that if I had any sort of business acumen, I think I would have been far more doubting. But it was a time of it was a boom time, right? And people get crazy in boom times. And I didn't have the wisdom to know that this was just crazy talk. So I believed it, and you know, I let my ego get out in front of me. Look how successful I am, and if I can do this once, I can do this three times. And so, one of the businesses I was able to sell to my partner at the time for a dollar. So it wasn't, you know, it was a failure in the grand scheme, but I didn't get hurt
by
it.
This is one of the businesses that you were doing while you were running Sun 2.
Yeah. We started a sidebar bar, a value-added reseller that had a very focused market, and then the other one. the other one, Prism, that blew up spectacularly.
That's the one where you took on the $5 million in debt.
Yeah, at one point. We were able to talk it down significantly, but it took time to get it worked down. But it was still, like, for about 18 months, like an elephant was just standing.
And it wasn't reduced down to nearly nothing. We'll get to that in a moment. No.
It was well north of all of my worldly possessions.
Probably. This is a big number, but we'll hold on to it. I want people to pay attention to till we get to that.
But it's important.
What was Prism?
You can work it down. If they see that this is not a solvable solution, you can work them down, which we did significantly.
I would have thought you could have worked that down to practically nothing, but I guess. So what was PRISM?
So PRISM was a wonderful acronym. It meant Proactive Remote Information Security Monitoring. Oh, great name. And it was started 2 months prior to Bruce Schneier starting Counterpain. And it was the same basic business model, which was working with Fortune 500 companies and taking in the data that was being, you know, thrown off by their firewall and intrusion detection system, monitoring it, and essentially ensuring that, you know, kind of have ADT or Honeywell for your perimeter security. It was a great concept.
So it's securing your office. If you want to make sure that if anyone tries to break into your office.
Not your office, but your data center.
Oh, your data center. I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like that for your network, computer network.
So I went back and I looked at articles from the time you were running it, and you said that one of the problems was you had a customer who didn't pay you for 9 months. It's really terrible to rely on a single large client that will not pay if they feel like it. Tell me about that. Who is the client? What kind of damage?
Well, they're so famous for putting small businesses out of business, and it's been so many years. You know, it was GE.
GE so, put small businesses out of business. How? What do they do?
They don't mean to. I mean, but it's funny. But, you know, they have, you know, like a lot of large businesses, they spend a lot of energy trying to negotiate really, you know, good terms, right? And then they leverage their vendors, and particularly if the market goes sideways or south, you know, they extend terms. And so, you know, it's, you know, 120 days is not unusual to see from large companies when, you know, times get bad, they'll just stretch it out in terms of paying their vendors. And that's what happened to us. And we didn't have the cash flow to be able to sustain ourselves.
To pay for what? What were the expenses you had?
Employees, mostly.
Okay.
It wasn't like we were running crazy. It was people.
And you also said, same article, Prism was getting nowhere with a strategic partner, which was negotiating a $1 million investment in a marketing deal. Mm-hmm. So this was GE also or someone else?
No, that was Bull Honeywell.
That was what?
Bull Honeywell. They did invest. They ended up putting the money in. So that was a misquote. But that was part of the debt.
Okay. So. I see. So they lent you money.
They lent me money.
I see. Okay. And then you also had, I don't see it here in my notes, but you also had a partner, I think, who was supposed to build this out and it was taking too long to get it built.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't up on the building side of the technology. What it was on the
clients.
We technology side, they were supposed to sell it, which seemed really smart. You know, they had all of these enterprise salespeople that were in fancy suits and they were well trained and they spoke enterprise. And, you know, we're just this little tech company from Wisconsin that's really good on the technology side. We'll build it and then they will go sell it. That was the idea. And so it was supposed to be, you know, a sales channel for us, for Prism, into the Fortune 500, which made a ton of sense on paper. Ton. The problem was, and this is something important for entrepreneurs to know, is that these particular sales folks were making money hand over fist on a cash cow that was dying, which was, at the time, it was data that was basically, it's hard to believe these things ever existed, but it was managing large data centers, not just data centers, but mainframes. It was outsourced mainframes. They had these huge data centers full with mainframes of their clients, of their Fortune 500, and they would maintain them for them. And obviously that was dying. And so they were looking for how to leverage their reputation and security, reputation and brand for the enterprise. And it made total sense on paper. And it still makes sense on paper. I don't think I would have necessarily, even with today, necessarily, unless I knew what it, you know, I obviously have knowledge, I wouldn't do the deal today. But if I just saw it on paper, it would still make sense.
Right. We build it. You have the partnerships. You sell it. You need a new product to sell because your cash cow is going to die. Okay. But yeah. They didn't make a single sale.
Nothing.
Nothing.
And the funny thing was the way in which the contract was worded, I was responsible if they didn't sell.
Oh,
and
wow.
This is where the dyslexia comes in. I did not understand that contract. And this is where being a poor CEO came in. I didn't ensure that I had enough resources reviewing it. I was so excited that they wanted to put money in. I was so excited that they wanted to partner with us that I overlooked a lot of things because I also thought there was no way we weren't going to be successful. There was no way this was going to fail.
I get that. I made that mistake because I had success early in life. And I thought then, of course, my whole life I was waiting to be in business. I started all these little tiny businesses for fun so I could learn and be prepared for when I finally am in business. I am in business. I'm hitting. Of course I'm invincible. All those other people were the kids who just didn't care about business. No wonder I'm beating them. And then, of course, you start to make mistakes when you think that way.
It's amazing how fast those mistakes come too, isn't it? And how embarrassing and usually how public.
And at the same time, how amazingly fast you wait for a long time to have the hit. And then Napoleon Hill said something like this, that when it comes, you're going to be showered with success. And it does happen. And of course, on the other side too, when it hits the fan and spreads all over the room.
Oh, there's just no way to explain it for anybody who hasn't been through it. But it is, you know, it is the best and the worst thing that ever happened to me. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me because it totally and utterly shattered my persona. There was nothing left at the end of it. I thought I was doing pretty good in my time. I mean, I was, you know, I felt like I looked smart. I thought I looked, you know, cool. I mean, I thought I was pretty hot stuff. And when the apocalypse happened, it shattered that persona, that false persona, so completely. It was just annihilated. And the rest of my career has been about trying to lead with authenticity because I don't have the luxury of going back and trying to put that monkey suit back together. It's just, it was incinerated. You know, so I don't think a lot of people think it's, you know, so great to talk about failure and stuff, but I think it's so important because there's so many different ways to success. You can be successful for a myriad of reasons. And there's just a few surefire ways to fail. And I seem to, with my trip up, hit a lot of them, which is lack of diligence to the details. Pride goeth before the fall. Trusting others, you know, particularly over-trusting legal and expert advice. I just got a whole bunch of advice that wasn't worth a hill of beans.
Why didn't your law firm tell you that this contract is putting you on the hook for something dangerous? That's a fairly easy thing for an experienced lawyer to tell you.
Well, it wasn't because I wasn't, at that time, necessarily working with a senior attorney. You know, I was working with a more junior attorney at the time, which wasn't, you know, and quite frankly, I didn't have enough money to pay him enough to really sit there and review it. So I was like, ah, don't worry about it. It wasn't really his fault. It was mine. And also, I just have to say that you can pay a lawyer a lot of money and get information back. And if you can't hear it or know how to process it, or you're nodding, you know, like you understand something, but you're too cool to ask stupid questions, quote unquote, which is who I was at that time, you're not really listening. You don't have the capacity or ability to actually hear what they're saying. And I think that was part of it too.
Sun Tzu, though, was sold, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
This is before the frustration, before you had to pay the $5 million in debt, or?
No. So that was all part of the fallout. So I actually, So we ended up selling Sun Tzu in 2003, and I had to unwind Prism in 2002. So I, you know, Sun Tzu was still a going concern, but you have to remember we'd had 9/11 hit too. So it was hurt with the downturn and the dot-com bust. It wasn't, you know, it was definitely a good company and it still had a lot of assets to it. So what we did is essentially it was more like a merger. We merged it into NeoHapsis, and I came on as CEO of the combined companies.
I see. But when you sold it, you still had all this debt. Did the sale help you?
It was not a cash transaction at that point. So it was just me still having this, you know, this burden.
And when you negotiated, you took $5 million down to how much?
Gosh, at the end of the day, I think it was 2.25. Yeah, actually it was.
So you still were on the hook for that. You didn't have that in the bank. How are you going to pay that? Or how did you end up paying it?
Well, you know, it was a series of fortuitous things, but you know, we got very lucky in 2006 and had a you know, good exit with NeoHapsis, and you know, I was able to continue to work things down. So it was a process, but today I'm debt free. So that's the big thing.
You know what? I was just talking to an entrepreneur earlier today who is still trying to get his business going, and we're talking about what happens to your self-esteem when revenue isn't coming in, when the business isn't doing well, it just shatters everything else. And you have to really work to stop thinking about the failure. You have to really work to remind yourself of what you want to do and your work on your confidence. How did you do it considering that setback? How did you run a business successfully?
I think I was finally ready to run a business successfully. Now, it took me 3 years at NeoHapsis to really earn my credibility there. The first 18 months, it was pretty sketchy. I mean, my ego was so hit and I was so low. And also remember, I'm a female and, you know, a female CEO of a tech firm. That's a kind of weird thing, particularly in security at that time. There was not a lot of women in information security at that time, not as a CEO. So it was a weird dynamic. And then 18 months in, I'd had enough success with the combined company. The combined company had grown significantly. And, you know, quarter over quarter, we were very successful in growing and we were profitable. And I eventually earned the trust of, you know, the team. And
how do you do it? How do you get yourself to a place where when you feel like a failure or not, you feel like a failure, you see, you made that face that, yeah, you do. How do you then lead other people with confidence, especially when you're trying to send people in a direction, they always want to question it because they want to understand it, or question it because they're used to a different approach. And you have to have the confidence to say, no, follow me. How do you do that?
It's a very interesting dance. I mean, for the first 18 months, I would say I didn't do it well at all. I would fight, you know, with my partner in crime and, my CTO, Greg, and we would just lock horns, and it was very difficult. And after 18 months, he learned to start really trusting me. And after that, things got a lot easier. But it was all based on results. You can't fake legitimacy. And Greg was there for the whole unwind of Prism. He saw the whole brutal reality unfold. And that was, you know, so he got to see me my lowest low. And in some way that was really good, but in some ways it was really bad, because he didn't, even in the beginning, he was very nervous about me being CEO. By the end of it, I think he was very proud and very, and I think it was a really good partnership. We did exceptionally well together. But that was an earned trust over time and with performance.
Can you give me a piece of advice that someone in my audience or I, when we're feeling like, when we're doubting ourselves, but still have to lead others that we can count on, that we can touch back in with?
Gosh, okay. So here's my trick. And it is a trick. I'm not going to claim that this actually will work for anybody other than me. I compartmentalize. What I do is if I'm feeling very doubtful of myself, I'll say, okay, I got it. I hear you. I'm going to put you aside for now because I can't listen to you right this minute, but I will come back to you. And I literally box it up and I put it on a little shelf. And I will do, I bet you mentioned Napoleon Hill. I do affirmations. I've had to talk myself up because you have to come from a place of authenticity, but at the same time, people sense when you're self-conscious, right? Or self-unsure. And it's killer in the CEO position. So you have to have a level of confidence. So the good news is, if I really feel strongly about something, about a direction or an idea, I can't fake it. I can't fake that it's like kind of like, I mean, I'm just very passionate. And that passion was able to come through, even though inside I was questioning whether or not I had the competency. Does that make any sense? I was just able to sort of put it aside. And it doesn't mean that I didn't, that I slept well at night. I didn't. I was constantly in this loop of, are they right? Am I really no good? I mean, there was a lot of very hard things, but the aha I reached, and this was not at Neo, it was after, it was really been at Harkin, is that actually there's a lot of things I'm exceptional at. And sometimes people can see it and sometimes they can't, but that doesn't matter. I can see it. I can see it.
And did you
And
just keep making sure that you reminded yourself, I am good at leadership, or I'm good at.
no, I never said I'm not. I would never say I'm good at
No.
it. Yeah, seriously, I'm not a
So, what
manager.
did you say that you're especially good at?
I'm especially good at relationships and sales.
And so, you just kept, when you were doubting, you'd keep touching back with that.
I'm sorry?
When you were doubting yourself, you'd just keep saying, no, I'm really good at sales. I'm really good at relationships. What, by the way, I got to take a pause here and ask you why. I noticed that too. You and I, before we started, I felt so comfortable around you. And you were saying things that a lot of people would have felt uncomfortable to say, like, because you wanted to get ready. Most people would have said, I don't know, they would have hidden the fact that they need to get ready and pretended that they just need to come on camera. So even with that, what was it? What do you do? You're introspective enough to tell me what you do, to tell the audience how they can do it too.
Yeah, here's the real trick.
Okay.
Learned in the process of failing and also in the process of just growing up. And growing up, I mean, really in my 30s and early 40s, that all the fears, doubts, worries that I have are shared by everybody. And that, my hidden conclusion prior to the big sort of break and disaster was that I was stupid, I was crazy, and I was a failure. And it was just a matter of time until the world found out and ran screaming. And so when Prism failed, I honestly came to the conclusion of, oh my gosh, it's happened. My hidden conclusion is now out there for the world to see because what I did was damn stupid, crazy, and I was a failure. There was just no way I could get away around that. And once that broke, and I didn't explode and or self, or and nobody ran screaming, and I still had friends. And people still cared about me. I went, wow. Well, it's so much better to be over here, and not be worrying about how people perceive me. I'll just be me. And people seem to like just me. And okay, I can do this. This is so much easier. And then I've really had since then 10, 11 years of practicing it, of just being me and saying what's on my mind and most of the time it works. Sometimes I offend people. Sometimes it lands badly, but I keep practicing and it just, you feel the fear and you do it anyway. Just be you.
Practicing is a good point, that even when you're trying to be you, it comes across badly or people
yes.
misinterpret it, and you just need to understand, hey, I'm practicing it. It's going to be bad now. I'm sorry this person's conversation had to be sacrificed to my practice and need to get better, but later on it'll be worth it.
Because authenticity is that the inside voice matches the outside voice. And for the first 5 years, the inside voice would come out and it was very unartful. And everybody would be like, oh, you know, what you think that, or you're, you know. And I was constantly trying to assure people I didn't mean it the way they took it. And that still happens to this day. I mean, I do tend to be misunderstood. It still happens. And it makes me laugh because, I mean, what I misunderstood, it's never like a little misunderstanding. It's like polar opposite of what I meant. And I'll sit there, I'm like, boy, the universe is really trying to serve it up in such a way that I can't continue to get triggered by the idea of being misunderstood. Because it used to be one of the things I feared so badly. Like, oh my God, people are going to misunderstand me. They're not going to like me. They're going to run away. And now they misunderstand me all the time. And sometimes I get upset. But mostly I'm just grateful that I don't have to sit there and practice what the perfect CEO thing to say is, right? I don't have to, you know, when I prep for this interview, you know, I'm prepping in terms of making sure I maximize the usefulness and utility of what I say so that somebody out there, hopefully just, you know, if it's only one, that's fabulous, that here's what I say, and they spend more time reading a contract, or they, you know, take that advice from a lawyer with a grain of salt, or they walk away from a given deal because just something doesn't feel right. If I accomplish that, this is really time well spent. So I'm, instead of trying to make sure that people listen and like me, which is a terrible intention, I try to make sure when I prep for things like this that what I have to say is actually genuinely helpful.
And one of the things that you want to say to the audience is be careful before signing personal guarantees. And you didn't even have to, maybe you could have gotten away without signing a personal guarantee back
then. No, not at that time. And not in my career. I have in Parkin. I mean, granted, I've got a ton of my own cash and I'm the bank of Parkin. So it's kind of irrelevant. But I haven't signed any personal guarantees with this company, which is the first time. You know, but I have an incredible amount of cash.
All right, let's talk about Harkin then. Where did the original idea come from?
My husband. Okay. He's incredibly just intuitive, creative genius. Well over a decade ago, he noticed that there was this missing. You know, you could share pictures online, you could share, you know, text online, you could, you know, share video online, but you couldn't share your voice online. And he came up with this idea of being able to share what he thought was sort of the piercing edge, which is joke content, you know, joke of the day. Everybody likes the joke of the day, you know, dial a joke meets the internet. Sounds like a great idea. He created a company called Yuckline. And then in 2006, we took it and took some of our proceeds from Neohapsis, and that was able to create the platform technology for Harkin. And at first we went out with jokes.
And it was a joke site. We're going to talk in a moment about how you found the pain that companies that do interviews have and how your solution helped alleviate their pain. But when it came to the joke site, was there any, the American Idol for Jokes, was there any pain you were trying to eliminate or were you just trying to fill what you thought was a hole in the market because there was video sharing sites and text sharing sites?
No, it was really about it from the beginning. It was all about voice, and voice is a media in the internet.
But it wasn't from a pain. It was just we have this technology.
Not a pain. It was the interesting thing was, I knew that I was okay as an executive where I was from an ego perspective because I was willing to be a CEO of a joke site. I was, you know, up until that point in my career, I had always been a CEO of very technically sophisticated, you know, things that people didn't understand. My mother never understood really what I did for a living. And I took great pride in that. And so I knew that I kind of arrived as an executive when I was thrilled to be handing out a card that said I was CEO of a joke site. I just felt so good about that. So it was a personal development thing. And at first, we was just going to be us. We didn't intend to bring in investors. We didn't intend to grow it. But the thing started to really grow and get some legs. And we went, okay, this is bigger than us. And
because
so,
people wanted to come on and tell their jokes and listen to other jokes. It was just, how did people find out about this? How did it grow?
I mean, so, you know, it was pretty viral. But there was also, we did some early advertising, especially after we brought on capital. And it was good. I mean, it was growing at a pretty fast clip. And yet the problem was we couldn't really monetize the content. Advertisers saw this particular type of user-generated content as too risky. And the one deal that we were able to get with Free 411, where it became joke of the day and we started getting some money for it, we had one guy call in. He called Walmart and said that one of the jokes was offensive. And that was the end of the revenue model. It was gone overnight. And no one had even called us. They just stopped sending us checks. So, yeah. Wah, wah, wah.
All right, and then you had this technology and you were looking for a new solution. How did you figure out the new solution and the next step for the business?
So there is a Lassie story that I could make up that would sound much better than this, but this is the real meal deal. We were at lunch and we realized that we couldn't monetize Comic Wonder and that we needed to figure out a different business model, and we had to figure out a different, because advertising was not working, and we also had to figure out a different content that we could serve up that people cared about, voice related. And so we're out for sushi, and it was Per Anderson and Jeff and I, and we're trying to figure out.
Jeff, your husband, Per,
Yeah,
was the
Jeff's my
VP.
husband. Per is our VP of platform, and we're trying to figure out, what assets do we have, And so we're really scrounging at this point. We've got the technology, we don't really have any customers. Do we? We've got relationships, and then Per offered up that he had this friendship with a gal who at the time was blogging, and she had about 300,000 subscribers, to her blog. And we said, "That's great, we'll call her, and she could use our technology to interview people, and then they could laugh at it and talk about how ridiculous that interview was, and make fun of it, and ha ha ha." And my husband Jeff said, "Why does it have to be funny?" And Per and I looked at him like he was an idiot. We're like, "Ah!" We kept talking about, how we were going to make this, entertaining thing, because our whole brain and the dominant logic was around comedy, even though the company was really about voice, right? But we'd gotten so into the comedy mindset, we couldn't really kind of get out of it. So Jeff that night went and did a ton of research, and the next day he came back and he said, "Do you know that depending on the year, but even if it's a heavy year or, a good year financially for GDP, doesn't seem to matter. 52 million Americans are hired every year." I said, "No, I didn't know that." And I said, "That's a half a billion interviews are conducted in the US alone." I said, "Well, that's interesting." He said, "Yeah, and today, it's a person and a phone and trying to schedule and connect to people in time. What if we use this for asynchronous interviewing? What if people could interview at their convenience anytime, anywhere, and then the recruiter could listen to it anytime, anywhere?" And that was the start of Voice Advantage. And in 2010, we won Product of the Year. And today, we've got the largest staffing companies in the world using our product, as well as many of the largest banks. So.
How did you get in the door of a recruiting company? I know it was tough and I know what they told you, but I think the audience needs to hear this too.
This is a good story. Okay. So the CIO of one of the world's largest staffing companies decided that he was willing to take a meeting with us. And so we walked in, and this is, so we still have Comic Wonder business cards, right? And we're here to show him the technology around Voice Advantage. So we walk in the door, we hand him, the global CIO of this company, our Comic Wonder business cards. He looks at my card, he looks at me, and he says, "Your only reason you're here is because your attorney is a friend of mine." And he puts it down. He says, "You got 5 minutes." And I'm like, "Okay." So we're off to a rocking good start here. So anyway, we do the demo for Voice Advantage, and we show them how, you can, just simply send out an email. Someone clicks on the email link, and they can now type in their phone number. The system calls them, so it's not like an, IVR. It's friendly, it's initiated by the candidate, and then the candidate can interview anytime, anywhere, and then the recruiter can listen to it anytime, anywhere. And we said, we think it'll speed up the total time to hire by, five, maybe 7x. And the truth is, now that we've got millions of interviews, it's closer to 10x. But at the time, we thought we were saying crazy numbers. And he sat back and he crossed his arms and he thought, and he said, "You don't solve the whole problem. But you solve about 30% of it. And if you do this and this, you'd solve about 70 of it." And he starts doing back of the envelope math, and he goes, you could save us about $70 million US only. And we went, and with this, we left that meeting. And at the time, my chief technology officer ended up writing me a check for $100,000 in the parking lot. It was that good of a meeting.
Wow. Wait, so how do you save him $70 million?
Yeah, I mean, so you got to think about it. So recruiting costs are exceptionally, I mean, what does a large staffing company do? If you are, okay, let's say they bring on a client. Let's say they land Bank of America. And Bank of America needs them to hire 4,000 call center representatives in Austin, Texas in the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they have to do is they have to hire close to 20 or 40 people just to do that. So the first round of hiring is they have to hire the recruiters to do it because they don't have that kind of bench. They can never have that kind of bench, right? And so it's an incredible, the cost of goods sold is actually really high. And the margin for the largest staffing companies is very, very low. It's like 12%. And so razor thin margins because people are their number one expense. But with our system, it allows one recruiter essentially to do the work of about 10.
Because one recruiter gets to zip through a bunch of interview answers without having to wait for a person to come in and another prospect and another candidate to come in after that. And
yeah,
I
well,
see.
So there's three things it does. One, there's no scheduling anymore. You come in Monday morning, you've got a stack of interviews that have been completed and you just listen to them and the total listening time is about a minute and a half per interview. So, they're able to make a very quick decision on these people that they might have spent 2 weeks chasing just to interview. The second thing is about 20% of the time, candidates don't show up for the interview. They might get another offer or decide they're not interested. So they fill that schedule and then they show up and boom, the plane takes off. You can't fill that half an hour or hour. And then the final piece of it, has to do with the multiple interviews, so you might have the interview goes well and now you got to ship them off to the hiring manager. Well, the hiring manager now has to re-interview that person.
And now they get all the questions there and the questions are consistent. So then why doesn't a text-based interview work just as well or video?
So when we started Voice Advantage, there wasn't really video. So we pioneered this field and video came out later. And it solves a different problem. It's usually much further upstream because you don't want to use video as the first experience when you're doing large volume hiring. It's good to get some data like a resume and or a quick phone-based interview before you see the candidate. But for text, you're missing all the nuance. It's a very low-resolution version of the person. It's like saying you can hire somebody off their resume. You just can't. You need to talk to them. And video will give you more information, but audio will get you about 80% there, and it's just more efficient. You can multitask a lot more easily with voice. It's why we don't do everything in video today. The reason is, well, quite frankly, I don't want you to see that I'm, taking notes or fixing my hair or drinking soda. We could Skype with video on everything, but we tend not to because we can get more done sometimes when we just listen.
Might also avoid potential issues around not hiring someone because of their race or because of the way they look.
Yep.
So basically, here's what it sounds like, and this doesn't feel right to me. I don't want to leave my audience with this idea that you had a joke site, you happened to come up with an idea, and boom, this guy loved it, and so you lucked into success. It doesn't.
Yeah,
it,
right. Yeah. So
what
that,
am I missing?
Okay. So pretty good. Okay. So that meeting was with one of our current clients, one of our top three largest staffing companies, but it took us 137 meetings. I kid you not. We had a poster on the wall where we took tick marks every time we met with them. We went through committee after meeting, 137 of them over the course of 4 years to finally land them as a client.
The first client?
Yep.
Wow.
Client.
So the person who said, you can save me $70 million, the guy who ended up, as a result, you got a $100,000 check in the parking lot from your partner afterwards,
yep.
137 meetings even after that.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And in those meetings is where the real work happens, where you persuade them, where you understand and you adjust your business to them. What's the biggest piece of feedback that you got at the meetings that you had to adjust?
In that particular case, not anything useful. The culture is just a very meeting consensus driven organization, and they did not end up purchasing until they screwed up. The
What do you mean?
reason they purchased our product in the end was because they had bid on a very large scale project and they screwed up the math. And it was not possible for them to actually meet the requirements of their own proposal without using technology. And so they scrambled and they called us. But they knew us because been there 137 times. But it wasn't until they couldn't actually make one of their biggest deals work because they screwed up the math.
So how are you not doubting yourself at that point? 130 meetings in, or 97 meetings in, I might go, this is not working out. They're just wasting my time. This isn't going to be a good business model.
So here's the problem. I didn't realize it wasn't working. So here's another piece of advice. I spoke information security sales. The folks that I had been selling to my entire career were more engineering types. If they took a meeting, they were definitely interested. And if they said, yes, let's do that, you could expect a contract. And it wouldn't happen 100% of the time, but I'd say probably 75% of the time. So I felt I had a really good read for sales, right? I knew what the buying indicators were. I knew what the buying language was. I knew this. Wrong audience. When I went into HR and started selling to recruiters, these are highly agreeable people. They're not engineers. They say yes all the time. They say no to people every single day, day in and out, and those people think they're saying yes to them. And that's what happened to me.
So you were
So
too naive to recognize that they weren't interested, and that's why you kept acting like they were interested. And so I see. And
because they
as a
kept saying, yes, we need this. Yes, this makes a ton of sense. Yes. You say that to somebody in security, you've got a contract.
oh,
You say
wow.
that to somebody in recruiting, and it's like, and but I didn't, I was tone deaf to it. So I only figured it out after, after Anne Ohm came on board. And she went to one of those 137 meetings and she said, Kelly, they're not buying. I said, they said next way that these are not buying people. They can't. They're not buying. They're just agreeable people. They will take your meeting every time. It was a horrifying revelation for But learn, we move on. But I eventually sell them
it
because
says a
they.
lot about being naively optimistic.
Yes, it does because it keeps you tenacious. It keeps you going. And there is a level of naivety because if you really knew how hard it's going to be, nobody would do this. And since this is my fifth startup, you can say, well, you know how hard it's going to be. And it's not true. I don't because I have amnesia. Every time I do well and I have a really good success, I forget all the pain it took me to get here. I only remember the good times. It's kind of like my children. They're really super cute. Wow, wasn't it wonderful having an emergency C-section? I don't remember
I've
it.
heard that. I've heard that really biologically, you do not remember it. It
Women are completely programmed to have amnesia around childbirth. And it's true. But it's also like that for something as traumatic as business creation, too. I think that there is something to say that the trauma of creation or generation, it creates, this false memory. It was always wonderful.
You told Jeremy, our producer, that the biggest challenge in the business is delay of revenue. Here online
Yes.
at Mixergy, if I sell something, I get paid before I even deliver it. For you, it's how long after you deliver it do you get paid?
No, it's
Oh,
all up.
revenue, not.
Yeah. Now, today, finally, we get paid up front.
Oh,
But
actually, delay of revenue is different from delay of payment. What do you mean by delay of revenue?
delay of revenue means that you think you've got the deal. You think you think it's all going to happen to the projections, right? And even for me, who puts a long tail, like for when we'll actually get paid. So most people assume 60 days. I always assumed 120 because I experienced that. You put those things in there, and it still doesn't map out. It still doesn't work. When you're pioneering a market, you're not dealing. And I want to do a blog post on this. There's a different type of physics. Like for instance, Newtonian physics. We use that language for business all the time. Like you want a lever. You want to leverage something, right? And grow. When you're in the pioneering phase of a startup, you're really in a quantum reality. It's all about possibilities. you can't use a lever. You can't create leverage if there's nothing there, if nothing's manifested yet. And so the delay of revenue really has to do with this, you know, a pioneering startup that's genuinely innovative. There's no market for it yet. There's no pull for it yet. The whole purpose of the entity is to figure out how to create something out of nothing. So it is really the world of quantum, right? And so you're trying to create these possibilities that you can ultimately someday, you know, lever and create what? Inertia, you know, you can grow it and it can be a real business. But in the early days, you know, projections are so meaningless because against what? I mean, so how do you know, you're going to grow this X amount per year, you know, really? Well, is it real? Is it a real client? Or is this just somebody just kicking the tires? You don't know until it becomes more of a business. And it goes from, you know, quantum possibility into, you know, physical, classical reality where, you know, Newtonian physics actually kind of work.
All right, here's something that did work out really well. You launch Symposia, which I mentioned earlier. DVR for meetings allows people to listen to audio of the meeting and search it in a way that we usually don't think of with audio. You put it out there. You and Anne, who you mentioned earlier, were in an art museum and something happened.
So we had had a really tough year. And we had, you know, projections had not manifested as fast as they were supposed to. And it was just painful. It was just painful. And I think we both sort of come to this, nobody wants our pretty baby. Why is this? You know, we've got this amazing, you know, product and company. Nobody thinks we're pretty. And we were at the Milwaukee Art Museum and we're sitting there in the coffee and we're trying to do like a little quasi mini strategic retreat just to sort of gather our thoughts outside the office going, what's going wrong? And all of a sudden the emails started coming in. And in the course of like just a couple hours, we've done $100,000 in sales. And, you know, for more mature businesses, they're like, so what? Well, this is, you know, this is coming out of that quantum reality to all of a sudden it's manifesting, right? It's right there manifesting. Well, we went from possibilities into business. And we didn't believe it. I mean, neither of us believed it was real. I mean, that was the funny thing. It's like, oh my gosh, we just closed this. We just closed that. We closed like three accounts in like the span of an hour. And it made neither of us could process it. So
and these
just
are accounts that you put in work to before. You close accounts by having real conversations with clients. This isn't about putting up a website. So you put in all the work before, and then while you were in the museum, boom, email comes in saying, yes, the deal came through.
Well, they sent us copies of the contracts and was like, what? No, we just propose. It's like that IBM commercial. I don't know if you remember from years ago. No, we don't sell things. We just propose. it was shocking. It was really shocking. And that was when we were like, okay, we actually have a business. We want our pretty things. You know, it was a magic moment.
Who uses it? Who needs to be able to search within their meetings?
You know, it's interesting. We're still finding the different use cases for it. But the fact of the matter is it's anybody who has ideas that are worth something. You know, at the end of the, it's negligent at the end of a meeting to walk away with just notes. If the conversation, in my opinion, was worth having, it's worth keeping. Because our memories are so flawed, and in this day, age of distraction, not being able to go back to a conversation and find that moment that was relevant, it's so wasteful. And what do? We keep having more and more meetings to try and remember what we said or to get things back in alignment because we were disagreeing now, or the worst kind of meeting, bring me up to speed. I missed that meeting. I just want to send them a link and go, here's a meeting. And go, here I texted things I thought were important. Feel free to search it for what you think is important. Don't talk to me.
I see.
So I think if anybody wants to be productive and to feel that meetings are crazy because they can't get the kind of value they want out of them.
By the way, Kelly, do you happen to have anything running in the background that might be using up bandwidth? It looks like something's chewing up bandwidth and keeping us from having the same connection we had in the beginning of the conversation. Like maybe Dropbox downloading something in the background, or even if you have a browser, sometimes that could, no.
No, let me just double check and see. I'll close the browser, but no, there's nothing being downloaded. The only thing I can think of is, you know, funny enough, you know, our data center is not in our offices. Our offices are awesome. They're beautiful, but they're on top of a residential building. And so we actually you know, for a internet company, you should have much better bandwidth than the corporate HQ. But
You know
yeah.
what? I'm in a corporate HQ. I pay $300 a month for the internet. It's still not as strong as it should be. For some reason, bandwidth is still an issue for all. You know what does work for me? Connecting my new iPad from Verizon to my computer, it was my backup internet connection. It's stronger than my landline. These guys are, it's unbelievable.
Love that. Go Verizon,
Go
go.
Verizon, go figure. All right,
Love it.
one last thing that I want to talk about. And it's late on a Friday. I appreciate you staying this late to do this interview. The last thing I want to talk about is everything's going well. You then get hospitalized for 2 weeks. And then what?
Oh gosh. So, you know, I have to be, you know, I don't mean to be political about it. I've got to be very careful, but it's, you know, what happened was, I got very sick and I couldn't figure out what was happening. And it was one of the kind of maddening sicks where I would be totally well and then boom, I would be down for a day or I would be down for 2 days with a migraine. And, you know, migraines are maddening. You know, you can't figure out where they're coming from. And I'd never had a history of migraines. This all had manifested in a very short period of time. And as you know from the beginning of the interview, I have tons of energy, high energy. I always run around. And all of a sudden, you know, not only did I have no energy, I was in a dark room or having to go into the hospital to get shots. So it all manifested in December, where I was in the middle of a fundraise, and I was prescribed a series of drugs for the migraine that I turned out I was allergic to, and I had a terrible drug interaction, and boom, I was out. And I've never experienced anything like that in my life. And it was really out of left field. I had no context for it. I had no idea what was wrong. But I was able to finally get a diagnosis and find out what was causing the headaches in the first place, which was I have celiac. I have a high gluten sensitivity. And anyway, so by simply changing my diet, I was back to being Kelly. And it took a while because I had to unwind all of the, you know, the medications I was allergic to too, get those out of my systems. But come January, I was back. But you know, my board was very nervous, and rightly so, because it was just, you know, you don't disappear like that. I mean, in the middle of a fundraiser, you're in the hospital for 2 weeks. What's wrong? We trust you. And so I had to go fly around the country and meet with all my investors and meet with the board, and you know, really, I mean, really get raised back and forth, because quite frankly, you know, people were not willing to invest in the company if I wasn't there. And that was very scary. So I actually had to go and show everybody no, rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. I'm here. It's a food allergy. It was an allergy medication. And
Did you
that is.
redo your business as a result of that? I mean, I understand you have to go and win back their confidence and you do get it back, but you always are a little doubtful, but you still
Sure.
have to build their business. You have to build your business differently, don't you? Once you discover that an illness or some time away can hurt it so badly.
You know, I was very fortunate. I mean, the fact of the matter was that Anne and my COO really runs the day-to-day operations of the company. And so she continued to do all the right things. Now, the problem was that all the right things didn't manifest until the next quarter, right? So it wasn't her, you know, so when I came back, I actually got to look like a hero. Because, you know, all the revenue hit, all the, you know, the clients closed, all of the things that we had promised, all the investors came back. And so it was kind of like the Rocky theme song, you know, it's like, I told you this would happen, you know, I wasn't making it up. Here it really is. We're doing the right things. So I'm senior enough, I guess, or mature enough as a manager to know that I'm not a great manager. I'm not an ops person. Anne is exceptional at that. And so Harkin has really been the team that's currently on is built around my self-awareness of my weaknesses. So even though, you know, I think most entrepreneurs will walk back into just a mess of an organization if they were gone for 2 weeks, the organization was absolutely fine. That thanks to Anne. I mean, Anne really kept the lights on and kept everything running incredibly well. So as me as a personal investor, you know, I ended up writing a very large check this round. I wrote a check for 125,000, and a lot of that had to do with my confidence and you know what? This company is bigger than me.
Wow, that is a good feeling to have, that somebody's got your back as an entrepreneur. You feel for most of your career that no one does. It's all on you, and it's a lot of pressure.
Well, it's very different. I mean, this again, I recruited Anne, and I recruited her for like 3 years before she came on. I said, together we're the perfect CEO. You are got this financial background. You're an ops. You're extraordinary at scaling, and you just think differently than I do. And she is great at HR. She can see through and really get a sense of people. I tend to fall in love with people, and so I'm not allowed in the HR process until we're really far along and we want to sell the person that comes back. And I am never used as a screener, which is ironic. You do. That's a maturity thing. And I highly recommend, it's almost impossible to do a really good startup by yourself. You need somebody on your team who's very different and grounds you.
I want to tell the audience about something that we've got coming up at Mixergy. And then I want to ask you about, here, I'm going to put it in the Skype chat so that you know what I'm talking about. The best advice that you suggested that, when Jeremy, our producer, talked to you about the best advice that you can give the audience, what you said. I think it's important for the audience to hear it. And the thing that I want to tell you guys, if you're watching, that's coming up, if you're Mixergy Premium members, I recorded a course with Sarah Hatter about customer service. I haven't even edited, Joe hasn't even edited it. He edited it yet, and I want you still to know about it and be on the lookout for it because it's so good. Sarah Hatter runs a company called CoSupport. If you ever get flooded with email from customers and you don't know how to handle it and you find that you're losing customers as a result of your inability to keep up with it all, if you're having trouble keeping up with all the emails that's coming in from potential customers or from just users of your site, I want you to watch this upcoming course because she took my tools and she showed me how to use them better, how to make sure that you solve people's problems before they ask you those problems, before they ask you about them. The tools that you already have are going to be supercharged after you listen to Sarah Hatter show you how to do customer service better. It's a course that we put on because I was desperate for it. Sarah is obsessed with it, so I asked her to come on here and teach it. I mean, she runs a whole business where she sets up everyone, other companies' customer support, and I asked her to do it. If you're a premium member, you already have access to it. If you're not a premium member, well, why would you not be a premium member? Go to mixergypremium.com and sign up now. I guarantee you'll love it and it'll be useful for you. The $100 plus a month that we spend on desk.com to answer customer support, just listening to her suddenly became valuable. Up until then, we might as well have been throwing that money out the window just using free Gmail. That is how good it is. All right, mixergypremium.com. All right, so Kelly, the advice that you had for the audience.
Yeah. My best advice is pretty simple. It's you can't lead others until you know what's driving you. All of us have something that we're scared of, our shadow, something that we believe to be true that really, in the grand scheme of things, isn't. Or
what's
even
driving
if it
you?
Is. Yeah, so early on, what was driving me was that fear of being a failure, of being, of being crazy, of being stupid, being found out that was who I was. So I spent my first half of my career pretending I wasn't those things. Then I realized I really was those things, so that's part of me, and it became a more integrated part of myself opposed to just a shadow. And I was able to really recognize and own the stuff that I do have, which, and there's a lot of assets, but it took me a long time to be able to identify those and say it. I could tell you my weaknesses in a heartbeat. But telling you my strengths, I would start, my palms would sweat. I could even feel my neck still getting a little warm. Thinking about talking about my strengths, I don't know what that's about. But, what I found at the ultimate key of success is just, be you. And if you're you and you're genuine and you learn over time and you stay with it, how to be artful about saying, keeping the inside voice and the outside voice matching, but in an authentic way that doesn't hurt people's feelings and make you unlikable. The key to success is likability. If people like you, they want to buy from you. They want to be with you. Well, they want to help you. And likable people tend to get ahead. And I just think that, there's a lot of reasons to be nice. There's a lot of reasons to be kind. But, for some people, maybe you need an extra push in that direction just out of fear.
And self-interest is a good push because people will buy from you if they like you.
Of course they will. I mean, think about the people we buy from. I can't think of one person that I buy from that I don't like in some way and or have gotten attached to one of their team members. Commerce is driven by trust and trust is driven by likability. So that's what it ultimately comes down to. So I guess that's my best advice. Learn how to be likable, which means learn how to be you and stop pretending to be a CEO or something else. Because just be you, if you show up continuously over time and learn how to do that artfully, you will be likable.
That's a good place to leave it. Very helpful. This whole interview has been helpful because you're willing to be open. I always say
scary too. I mean, I still to this day, I always get nervous, but I'd rather do it than not. So thank you for saying that.
At the end of interviews, I often say to the audience, look, if you got anything valuable out of this, if you felt that this was meaningful to you, don't act like someone who's watching a movie where you're disconnected from the action. You're in business just like we are. Find a way to connect with Kelly and say thank you. And I just got an email recently from Eric Sue in the audience, and he said, Andrew, thanks. I got an online marketing consulting gig with Grub With Us. Grub With Us, his founder, did an interview here on Mixergy. He goes, my friend was offered a full-time job plus equity with them as a result, just because they shot an email saying, hey, thank you for doing this interview. Thank you for teaching me something valuable. Thank you for being open. So I'm not saying to the audience, do it because of self-interest. I'm saying just do it because somewhere good things are going to come to you. Find a way to do what I'm about to do right now, which is to say, thank you, Kelly, for doing this interview. And Kelly, if they do want to say thank you, how do they connect with you?
Sure. I'm always reachable via email. So it's just kelly@harkin.com. That's kelly@harkin.com. Feel free to shoot me an email, and I'd be more than happy to connect with you.
And for the transcribers, let's get the spelling right on this. It's HARQEN.com. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you all for watching.
Thanks so much. Really a pleasure.
Thank you.